So, good morning, everyone. Before we start, two things. Today, Professor Seidel is on a business trip, so you have to deal with me. And secondly, Happy New Year, everyone. So, let's start and get back. So, in the last lecture, we have dealt with the problem of register assignment of variables, and we have seen a basic algorithm for basic blocks. Well, we have computed their life ranges, and we saw that these life ranges, if they intersect, then these variables, the interference graph builds. And in order to get a better or in order to get a smaller amount of registers, we made use of this life range splitting by introducing new variables whenever we have an assignment to a variable x. We introduce a new fresh one, this x1, x2, and so forth. But this only works for basic blocks, and of course, we want to deal with control structures like if-then-else, or we want to have loops, and so on. And here comes this idea of this static single assignment form into play. And we already started by introducing this step one and step two. And the idea of this step one is to transform the program such that each program point is reached by at most one definition of a variable. And we assumed that all these variables are live. In this second step, we came up with this idea to introduce a separate variant for every occurrence of a definition. So we introduced this x1, x2, and so forth. So this is nothing new. And then we have a transformation which replaces every use of this variable x with the actual reaching variant. So, if we have a look at this, what does this mean? So we have, for example, something assigned to x5, and then we have something assigned to x2. And by this step one, we have to make sure that if we have, for example, a join point here, that, well, at this point, we have two definitions reaching for this variable x, namely x5 and x2. And by this step one here, this is actually forbidden. And we came up with this idea of this parallel assignments, where we had this x equals x over here. In order to circumvent this problem, so we assigned actually, we have introduced a new fresh variable, so assume that x7 is new, then we assigned x2 and x5 to x7, and then again this assertion in step one holds, so and at this point only the definition x7 is reached at this point. So here, we have to determine for every program point the set of reaching definitions, and this is somewhat similar to the analysis of available expressions. So there is nothing special here. Then for each incoming edge, if we have a join point here at this V, then we come up with these parallel assignments for some set LV at this join point V. And initially, we set the set for each program point to the empty set. The idea is then, if this join point V is reached by more than one definition, then, one definition of the same variable, then we insert this variable x into the set LV. And we add these definitions, these parallel assignments, x equals x, at the end of this incoming edge. And the goal here is to keep this set LV for each program point as small as possible. I mean, trivially, you could put every program variable in this set LV and do this parallel assignment for each variable, of course. Then we also get this static single assignment form somewhat. But, yeah, this is not what we want because this would obviously slow down the program. So we want to keep this set as small as possible. So here we have an example. We assume that each program variable is initialized. So initially we have for x and y that the reaching definition at this node 0, so they are somewhat initialized. Then if we proceed, for example, if we have a look at this node 1, what definitions are they reaching? Well, obviously everything from node 0, but we have an assignment to x. So first of all, this variable y stays the same. So it's still the definition is reaching there from node 0, but we have an assignment to x. That means the definition which actually reaches there is x, 1. Then for node 2, what we observe there, that we have actually these incoming definitions of this variable x by this node 1, but we also have an assignment to x, namely here at this node 5. That means we also have an incoming definition from this branch. So from this branch, we have an incoming definition for x, and from this branch, and similar for this program variable y, we have an incoming edge here at this node 2, and we have a definition also at this node 4. So here we have also this reaching definition y, 4. A guard obviously is not a definition, so it doesn't change anything. So at node 3, everything stays the same. But for node 4, so what is actually there reaching? So at node 4, well, we observe that the definition of this variable x at node 1 might be reaching. So if we go along this path, then x might come from this node 1, or it could also happen that this x is actually coming from this node 5. So we have these two possible definitions for this variable x, but for this variable y, we only have the definition at node 4 because, well, we have this edge here, which is a definition of this y, and this removes, obviously, all the other definitions. And, yeah, we can go on. Same game holds for this node 4. So there we again have an assignment to the variable x. So this is this one here, which then overrides. So intuitively you can think of an override of this variable x, 1. So the only reaching definitions at node 5 are then x, 5 and y, 4. Okay. So then what happens at this joint point here? Well, we observe that we actually have two definitions, namely for this x we have this at node 1 and at node 5, and for this variable y we have incoming definitions from node 2 and node 4. And then we introduced this idea of this parallel assignment, where we do this x equals x and y equals y for this join point. Once again, we have for at least one variable two incoming definitions. Okay, so what transfer functions and what domain do we actually have for this reaching definitions? Well, the complete lattice is given here as the power set domain of all the definitions. And what is a definition? Well, that's a tuple vars times nodes. So this is this x comma 3, for example. And we have a helper function here, this defs of x. This is just all the definitions of x at each node. So then, how is the transfer function defined? Well, for an assignment here to x, we remove all the definitions which have been previously in R of x. And then, well, since it is a new definition and the arc is actually going to this node v, we add this tuple x comma v to the set of reaching definitions here. And, well, for a parallel assignment, so how does there a transfer function look like? Well, what we do is we, for all these parallel assignments here in this, so for all the variables in this set L, we remove all the definitions in this set R, and then we add these tuples x comma v, because again we are reaching this node v. So this is an arc to this node v. Yeah, and the ordering is given by this subset inclusion, and yeah, the start value is given by so we assume that all the variables are somewhat defined or initialized at the program start. Okay, so then let's have a look at the transformation, the step one for the static single assignment. So there, we only do this for join points, so if we have more than one incoming edge, then we introduce this parallel assignments only for variables which are live at this program point V, so we are interested in something like this. And we are only interested in these variables which have more than one reaching definition. So if this number is strictly greater than one, then we have at least two incoming definitions, and then we introduce this parallel assignment, and we do this by introducing a new node in between here, and then we have this parallel assignment psi here. Okay? So, well, this is, well, I would say a little bit artificial, but nevertheless, we have to deal with that. If you have a control flow graph for the start node, which has a second or a third incoming edge, so at least more than one incoming edge, we do more or less the same. We introduce extra nodes here, and we do this parallel assignment psi over there, too. 2. Okay. So let's discuss this a little bit. As we said before, at this program start, we assume that every variable is actually defined. And at some edges, we introduce these parallel assignments, psi. And, well, actually, some of these parallel assignments might be useless. So can you actually think of a CFG where we have a useless parallel assignment? Can you think of something like that, where it's somewhat superfluous? So, well, we might think of some graph like this. So there we have, for example, something like this one. So that means at this node here, we have two definitions of this variable x, namely this x2 and this x5. And then, well, we can go on with that and assume we have a skip edge here. Then, again, at this joint point here, we have two reaching definitions, again, x2 and x5. And if we plainly apply this as we have done before, we would actually introduce this, this joint point, we would introduce this parallel assignment for x2 and x5, and we also would do it over there and introduce these parallel assignments psi. But actually, once we have done it here, then only one definition is reaching down there, and the second parallel assignment is somewhat useless. We don't actually need it, but we have done it. So how can we deal with this? We do this only in case, so we introduce only these parallel parallel assignments if the sets of reaching definitions of this variable x from the left and from the right-hand side of a branch differ. So that the differ is somewhat important, and then we can circumvent the problem of these useless definitions of these parallel assignments. And this is more or less all the step we do, and we do this in a fixed point computation. So we do this, we repeat this step until actually each node is reached by exactly one definition of each variable, which is actually live at this node V. Okay, sounds somewhat promising so far, but now we might think of, does this actually terminate? So, here we have a nice theorem, and first, well, we assume that every program point in this control flow graph is reachable from start, and that every left-hand side of a definition is live. Then the algorithm for this insertion of these parallel assignments terminates after at most n times m plus 1 rounds, where, well, n is this number of variables, and this m, well, this is the number of program points. So this means, so what intuitively, what can happen? We don't introduce new join points. So this stays statically. But we introduce more parallel assignments. And in the worst case, what might happen? Can you think of something? So, I mean, this transformation is all about introducing these parallel assignments. Once again, we don't introduce new join points. This stays constant. But we introduce more and more parallel assignments. And in the worst case, we introduce as many parallel assignments as we have of program variables. But after we have added all the program variables to this parallel assignment, so x equals x for all the program variables, then we are done and we definitely found a fixed point. And the good thing then is that after this termination, then we are sure that at every program point u, this set R of u has exactly one definition for each variable. So at each program point, only one definition of each variable is actually reached. Okay. Then we might have a look a little bit at how efficient this analysis is. And what we observe is that this efficiency crucially depends on the number of iterations. I mean, of course, as if we do more iterations, then it will slow down, and we are interested in keeping the number of iterations as low as possible. And a nice observation is here is that if the CFG is well structured, then it actually terminates already after one iteration. And what does well-structured mean? Well, essentially, such programs are while programs. So this means we essentially only have a do-while loop or a while loop and an if-then-else, but we don't have extra go-tos. That means we also don't have a break or a continue in a while loop. Okay? So this is then called a well-structured program. And for well-structured programs, what we observe there that, given a well-structured CFG, this CFG can be reduced to a single vertex by the following steps. So we can, if we have a branch, we can merge this branch, so we have then only a single edge here. Or if we have a loop like this one here, then we can remove this loop. And the third thing is, if we have two consecutive arcs, we can remove the inner one, so we are left just with one arc. And if we apply exhaustively these rewrite rules, intuitively you can think of these as rewrite rules of a control flow graph, then if a program is well structured, then you end up with a single vertex V. I already see some faces. So did you understand that? So this is not about keeping the semantics, but intuitively, if you apply these rewrite rules and you end up with a single node, then you know that your program is well structured. If you apply these rule exhaustively and you still you are still left with more than one node, then something went wrong. So we might have a small example. We, I guess, as an example, it was, yeah, you always had this factorial number thing. So something like this. If this is our control flow graph, well, this was the endpoint, then you can apply, for example, by removing this thing here. This was this intermediate node thing which we could remove. And, well, we can do this same thing on the other branch. So we remove this intermediate node. And once again, we can remove this intermediate node there. So we are left with this one. And, well, then we see we have a loop with a single arc. Then we can also remove this thing. And then, well, there is only this node there. We can remove this one. And, yeah, we are done. Okay? So this is the idea. If we give you a control flow graph, and you can exhaustively apply these rules, then you know that this program is well structured. Okay? Then let's go back. How can we actually go back? Ah, okay. Yeah, and if you have a look at the literature, there's done a lot of effort in keeping the efficiency of this analysis in order to keep this analysis very efficient. And what you actually observe is that in practice, the programs which you actually do this register assignment for, they are often more or less in this well-structured form. So it's not that important that you try to be very ambitious here and come up with a very fancy static single assignment analysis and come up with a lot of heuristics in order to optimize and the efficiency of the analysis, because, well, in practice, you often find these well-structured programs. Here it's already there. So these reducible CFGs, these are not the exception, but more or less the rule. And if we have a look, for example, at Java, then this reducibility is only violated by loops which have breaks and continues. And if we think that our analysis is not as fast as we actually want to, then we can always introduce a safe breakpoint. So assume after k iterations, our analysis still did not find a fixed point, so we didn't terminate. Then we might immediately terminate our fixed point iteration by inserting these definitions, these parallel assignments, x equals x, before all the nodes which have more than one reaching definition of this variable x. So this is always a safe thing we can do. So if we really run into trouble and, let's say, after k iterations we still didn't find a fixed point, then we can break here. So then, in the following, we assume that every program point u is reached by exactly one definition for each variable which is live at this program point. Okay. So let's have a look at this second transformation step. Here we replace actually the label by, so we have a edge from U to V with this label lab, and we replace the label by this fabulous function. And well, before we actually have a look at how this is formally defined, we will sharpen our intuition. So what do we actually want to achieve is that we now, well, we introduced these parallel assignments, x equals x, and now we want to relabel these variables. So whenever we have a definition of this variable, and this is an edge to this node v, then we want to replace this variable by x subscript v. And we do this for these definitions, but if we do this for the definitions, we obviously have to do this also for the uses in the right-hand side of all the expressions. And this is what we are going to do here and what is formally given. And it looks somewhat ugly, but the intuition is, I think, pretty simple. And yeah, so we introduce this by this function t, and we have a helper function, this phi of x, and this is defined as follows. If at this node u, so this node u here, this is where this arc starts, and if at this node u, we have the reaching definition of x from node u prime, then this helper function, this phi of x returns x subscript u prime. Because, well, the definition of this variable x at this node u comes from u prime. Okay? So this is what we do, and yeah, I mean, a skip edge, nothing happens there. Then, well, if we have a guard, a negative guard, what we have to do is we have to relabel all the variables in this guard expression E and substitute all these variables X with their proper definition. The same we do for a positive guard. There is nothing special. But we might have a look at an assignment. This is more interesting. And first, this is an edge. So I should probably mark it blue here, going to this node V. So again, here's this subscript V. And here again, we have this subscript V. And since it's reaching this node V, we know that this variable should be actually labeled with this subscript v. And then we do the same thing as for this positive and negative guards, namely the right-hand side, the expression, all the variables in there, they have to be relabeled too with the proper definitions, which actually reach this node before, namely this node u. So this is somewhat important, and there we have this, this helper function phi, which labels then all the nodes. And yeah, we do the same thing for, the same thing for an assignment from the memory to this variable x. Again, this is a definition then reaching this node V. So we label this variable X subscript V, and we just have to relabel the variables in the right-hand side. And yeah, I think this one is clear what to do here. We only have to relabel the variables in these expressions E1 and E2. So more interesting, what happens for these parallel assignments? What do we do here? Again, these parallel assignments, they all reach this node V. So the left-hand side, the definition is then X subscript V. And on the right-hand side, we have to relabel the variables x with a former definition of this variable. So this is somewhat similar to this to this thing here. This is then somewhat similar. Okay, so maybe we should do a small example. So assume we have a node U and a node V here, and we have a definition of X, and let's say we have this expression on the right-hand side, then this variable X gets this subscript V, because this is then the definition which reaches this node V, and assume that this node Y was defined at node, let's say, 5, then we have to relabel this node Y in this right-hand side in this expression. And this is actually what we do by this function T. Okay? Clear so far? Then, what have we done so far? We had this multiple assignments, and we assume that these multiple assignments are executed in parallel. So this is assumed that this is a parallel assignment. So essentially, this should be the semantics of this parallel assignment from this top here. So this is not done sequentially or so. So this is done in parallel. Okay, so let's come back to an example. Here, what do we have? So first of all, is this right? Okay, by abuse of notation, the subscripts of these variables actually does not correspond to the node which is reaching. But we abuse this notation right now. Nevertheless, we have an definition of this variable x coming in from this side here. But we also have a definition of this variable x coming in from this side. So we have to introduce, at least for this variable x, we have to introduce a parallel assignment. And how does it look like? Well, here it is given, at least for this branch from this side here. So we introduce a fresh variable. So let's call it x3. And from this branch, x1 actually reaches this one. And from this branch, this is X2, which reaches this one. So we have an assignment here to this X3, where we assign X2 to X3. And likewise, for this variable Y, we have an assignment here, and we have an assignment over there. So this is y1 and y2. And again, we introduce this fresh variable, this y3, and we assign it from the branch coming in from the top, this y1. And from the loop, we assign y2 to this y3. So, and then once we have done this, we also have to take care of these in these variables in these right-hand sides of assignments. So if we have a look over there, well, in our guard expressions, we have to replace this x by the actually reaching definition there of x, and this is, well, at node 2, only the only reaching definition for this variable x is then x3. So here we substitute this x by this x3, and also, well, here in this loop at node 4, the reaching definition is x3 for x, and similar down there, and we also have to relabel this y here in this right-hand side, and the reaching definition is then this y3, which comes from this node 2. And last but not least, here in this right-hand side, down there at the very end, we also have to replace this y by this y3. Okay, so far so good. We might have a look at this observation. Again, we assume that every program point is reachable from start and that the program is now in SSA form without assignments to dead variables, so everything is live. Then what we observe is that we denote by this lambda that the maximal number of simultaneously live variables in this program. And by G, we denote the interference graph of the program variables. And we then have that this maximal number of simultaneously live variables equals the maximal number, so the maximal size of a clique in G, and that this number also equals the minimal number of colors of G. Okay. And furthermore, what we have is that a minimal coloring of G, that means an optimal register allocation, can be found in polynomial time. By this theorem, actually, this number of required registers can be easily computed. So this is somewhat nice. And this allows us to spill these variables, which actually have to be spilled to the memory. No. That they can be determined beforehand of subsequent assignments. And so here we can actually insist on keeping iteration variables from inner loops in registers. So these inner loops, they are more frequently executed. So these variables we might want to keep in registers, and the variables from outermost loops, these ones might be spilled to the memory. If we, in practice, we don't have a machine with infinitely many registers, so there are often variables have to be spilled to the memory. Okay. So, well, you know, this is just a theorem. We didn't prove it so far. So, but what can we actually say? Well, that this number of live variables, that it is that these live ranges, well, of these variables, they intersect of all other variables, so they somewhat form a clique, and that this number is then less or equal than the maximal clique of a graph is obvious. So this holds. And then we might think about a little bit about this. Well, the minimal number of colors which we need in order to color the graph, that this is greater or equal then the maximal clique is somewhat also obvious. So this is clear. But the question which remains to prove is that does it really suffice lambda many colors in order to color the whole graph? And actually, we could try to prove this right now, but we can actually come up with an algorithm which operates directly on the control flow graph, and we can spare us all these details of proving. So first, we have a small observation here that these life ranges of variables in programs in this static single assignment form, they somewhat behave similar to life ranges in these basic blocks. For example, consider some depth-first search spanning tree of the CFG with a root start. And what we observe here is that for each variable x, the life range forms also a tree fragment of this T. So what is a tree fragment? First of all, for these basic blocks, we had something like this, and we had a life range which was something like this. And this was a life range of a variable x, for example. And this is obviously a tree. And now, what is a tree fragment? So assume we have a tree over there, and there is a subtree, and we have something like this, and let's say here's a tree, and there is some subtree, and now a tree fragment is something like this. This thing in this blue area, this is a tree fragment. So, we can also generalize it. So you might have something here also on top like this. So this is a tree fragment. And then these life ranges, they obviously also form a tree fragment. And once again, this tree fragment is just a subtree of some tree where some of the subtrees have been removed. So here we just removed these things here and this up there. So this is then a tree fragment. So let's get back to our example. So what life range do we have here? So we have already given here this life range for this variable x. This is life at node 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Now, what life range do we actually have for this variable y? Well, this is life at node 6 and this one. So this is for this life range for this variable y. Then at which program point is this variable I live? This is just at this node 0. And is something left? X, Y, I. Oh, this variable A. This variable A, this is life everywhere. Okay, so what we actually see here, that although this program is not in static single assignment form. These life ranges, they still form tree fragments of this graph. Okay? So this is somewhat interesting, but if this program is in static single assignment form, then we are guaranteed that these life ranges, they actually build tree fragments. So this is somewhat important. In static single assignment form, this is guaranteed. But also, this is a nice lesson here that you can also have life ranges for programs which build a tree fragment or which form a tree fragment for programs which are not in static single assignment form. Okay. There we are given that. So again, this is a nice observation here. The program is not in SSA form, but all these life variables, their range still forms tree fragments. And similar as we've done it for these basic blocks, the intersection of these life ranges, they build a life range. So we had a life range here, and we have a life range there. And we have, if we intersect two tree fragments, we again get a tree fragment. And, well, we have another nice observation here that a set C of tree fragments, they form a clique if and only if the intersection is non-empty. And, the greedy algorithm will actually find an optimal coloring. So we can actually prove this intersection thing, but we will skip this and immediately switch to the greedy algorithm, which is somewhat important. So how does it actually work? Well, at the very beginning, we have this you can think of this map or an array, this visited, where we keep track of which node we actually visited of this CFG. And at the very beginning, we have to initialize this such that no node has been visited. So we set it to false. And then we color the start node. So this is done in the second step here. For all these live variables at this program start, we assign them a color, and the color is keep track in this gamma. Oops. In this gamma thing here. So there we save the actual color for this program variable X at this program point start. And then how do we color it? Well, here we have this fabulous function extract free. So this actually takes the smallest color, which is actually free at this node right now. And then we call this function alloc. And as a parameter, we have this start node. So how is this function alloc defined? Here it is given. And yeah, again, as a parameter, we assume that we get a node. And then, well, we set this visited of this node to true. So finally, we visited this node. And then we have a look at all the outgoing edges of this node U. So this is given here. So these edges of this U, they are then just, they have a label lab, and they have an endpoint at V. And if this node V has then not been visited so far, so if it has been visited, we don't do anything, nothing special here. But if it has not been visited so far, then we have to color all the nodes which have been life and colored so far at this node U, but not at node V. So we have to insert then these to this set free. So we have to free them, and then, well, we have, sorry, the other way around. So if these variables are not live at this node V, then we can actually free them, and then we have to color them. So this is done here. So for all these variables which are live at this node V, which are new at this node V but not at node U, we color them with this free color here. And then we call us recursively here and do the coloring for this node V. Okay, so once again, important here, what you should keep in mind is that we first free colors, and then we assign new colors to these variables in order to really get a minimal coloring. So we will see this in a second in an example why this ordering. You also could flip these steps, but then you don't get a minimal coloring. So here we have an example. I think this is not a running example in this lecture. This somewhat looks artificial. Okay, so, well, we have this variable x, and we assign it to the register R1 here. So this is a free color then. Then we have an assignment to this variable y, which we color with this register R2. And previously, we had this variable x held in this register R1. Then again, we have to color these things here, so we have to rename them. This variable y is now in this register R2. And then we proceed here on the left-hand side by first freeing the colors which aren't used anymore. So this is this variable x, so the color R1 is removed. And then this free color can be made used for this new temporary variable t. And here's the ordering. You see the ordering? We first free the colors, and then we assign colors to the variables. So here, this R1 is freed and made used of, and then, well, this variable y has still this color R2. And on the right-hand side, we have a similar situation. Beforehand, this variable x is kept in this register R1, but since we free the color first and then do the assignment, we can immediately make use of this color for this temporary register Z here, so we assign this to R1. Yeah, and then we have it here on the right-hand side. Okay, clear so far? So then, let's move on. We have some observations that these intersection graphs for these tree fragments, that they are also very well known as caudal graphs. So this is not an invention from us, but something which the graph theorists... Oh, caudal is actually... It's written with an H. So it's written like this, caudal. And... So what is actually a caudal graph? So this is a graph with three or more nodes which forms a cycle. So assume something like this. This is a cycle, but that now it's not a chord so far. So what happens here we need these edges. Now this graph is a chordal, and you might see these graphs by looking at them and finding these triangles. So we have here a triangle, and we have a triangle over there. So this is then a chordal graph. So here it's given. So it's an undirected graph where every cycle with more than three nodes contains a chord. And there are another subclass of perfect graphs. And what we now observe is that, well, so far we have actually solved an NP problem in P time, right? So we came up with a polynomial time algorithm in order to save this coloring problem. But this coloring problem is an NP problem, so did we actually solve P equals NP? Why not? You're shaking your head. Why is it not possible? Yeah, but it's still open, so no one knows. Yeah. Okay. There's one thing which we somehow neglected so far, namely these parallel assignments to registers. So far, we completely ignored this problem. And we introduced these parallel assignments while transforming this program into SSA form. And this is actually the thing, while this is not a proof that P equals NP. I'm sorry for that, but we can't prove it here right now. Okay. So far, here's an example. We had this parallel assignments, and we have here an assignment of R1, where we assign the value of R2 to R1, and then from R2, we assign the value of R1. So this is more or less a classical swap. And there are several ways to implement such an exchange. And as far as I know, the hardware vendors somewhat jumped by and tried to help the compiler designers by introducing special instructions for that. If I'm not mistaken, the Intel architecture supports has a special instruction for swapping registers. Is here somewhere a hardware hacker around who can say that this is true or not? No? Okay. But I'm pretty sure that there is a special instruction. But nonetheless, there are at least two ways to implement this. And I guess the very basic thing, which you actually also see in the GNU C library, that they just make use of auxiliary register. So there is also in this GNU C library, there's a swap function, and they just make use of an auxiliary register. So that means we first, before we assign or before we destroy the value of R1, we save it in an auxiliary register R, then we assign the value of R2, we save it in R1, and then we can take the value which we have saved in this special register R to R2. Okay, so this is one way, and this is another way, which you've probably seen in Informatik 1 or Informatik 2 here at the TUM. Which is somewhat mind-boggling, at least for me. I was somewhat surprised when I first saw this, that by this XOR thing, that somehow, at least for me, it was magically in the very first semesters, that this exchanges the values without making use of an auxiliary register by just applying three times this XOR. But now comes the question, what about cyclic shifts? What happens there? How can we deal with that? So we assign R2 to R1 and so forth until we do this RK minus 1. We assign the value of RK. And then finally, this RK is assigned the value of R1. So with a cyclic shift. And how can we actually deal with that? Well, that's not that big of a deal, because this means we have to do just swaps of two registers. And, well, as you already see down there, we need at most k minus 1 swaps. So now we can think of a more complicated thing if we have a permutation. And what is a permutation? Well, this is, we can decompose such a permutation into a set of disjoint shifts, or in this case also swaps. And we can actually, so we have here, given that any permutation of n registers with this R shifts can be realized by n minus R swaps. So let's have an example given down here. So we have, what is given here? So we have R1 is assigned the value of R2, and R2 is assigned the value of R5, and here R5 is assigned the value of R1. So this is one cycle, and then the other cycle is given here. R3 is assigned the value of R4, and R4 is assigned the value of R3. And here are also the cycles given. And yeah, in total, we can do this by these three shifts. Okay, so we have the cyclic shifts, now we have these permutations done, but what about the general case? The general case, so intuitively, what does this mean? What means general? So we might have the case that the value of one register is assigned to not only one variable, but, for example, to two variables. So assume we have a cyclic shift here, so this is nothing new. But now, in the general case, we might have something like this. So the value of this variable here is assigned to two variables. And what does this mean? So, well, this is more or less already the general case. So we also might have something like here going and going over there, so an assignment. But what we can't have, so once we have a cycle, we can only have trees afterwards. So what is not allowed is something like this, where we would have, again, a cycle. This is not allowed because, well, what does this mean for this node here? This means that we have two assignments to it. And this is something which we forbid by construction. So this does not happen in our case. So this is not allowed. But afterwards here, we just have this trees then. Okay? And, let's have a look at this example down there. So remove all the scribblings. Maybe we should draw the graph here. So we have an assignment here from R1. So we assign the value of R2 to this R1. Then we have an assignment of R2, the value of R4 is saved in there, and then we have a cyclic shift here for this node. So So we have a node 3 and a node 5. So here we have a cyclic shift. And this is, well, obviously a cyclic shift. And here what we already observe for this thing here, that it's that this assignment is a linear register move, and this can be implemented like this one here. So this is just a move, and for the cycles, there's nothing special here. We again have these cyclic shifts. And intuitively, how would you start by this? You would traverse down to a leaf, and then you go upwards, and once you reach a cycle, you can do this shifts in whatever way you like. Okay. Then we are coming already to an end. For the interprocedural register allocation, it is a little bit more complicated because we have to deal with local variables. And a local variable in a procedure call is only valid in this current stack frame of this procedure. And so this is given here. So for each procedure call, we have this stack frame in which the local variables are held and in which they are valid. And now what do we actually do when we have another function call? So in that case, these local variables, they have to be saved, or these local registers, they have to be saved. And this is done by spilling them on the stack frame. And afterwards, once the call returns, we have to restore these local variables. And in order to perform this step, there is hardware support for this, and sometimes there is not. And if it is our duty to keep track, so if we don't have hardware support, then we have to save and restore these local variables. And there are things where we can optimize a little bit. And we might only want to save registers which are actually overwritten, and restore then only these overwritten registers. So that means we don't have to spill all the local variables to the stack, but only those which are overwritten. We might think of this idea here. We save only registers which are still live after the call. So we perform this small optimization. Okay, then we are coming at an end. Do you still have questions? Okay. Then see you tomorrow all in the tutorial.